Provide security podcast with Martin and Steve Yvette and Little Joe. News Yankee Steve giving weekly updates. Armor guy managing the microphones. Joseph's there and sparkles while the vet's in the airport. Andy Googles Microsoft on his iPhone. A family-friendly bucket full of southern goodness. What will they be ranting about this week?
It's episode 119 of the Southern Fried Security Podcast. I'm truly afraid, y'all. On the Skypes today, we have the complete crew together for the first time in what I think is ages. Joining me on the Skypes from the podcasting crew, I've got my good friend Andy Willingham. I've got Steve Reagan. I've got Joseph Sicoli, and I've got Yvette Johnson. How's it going, y'all?
Hello.
It goes good.
There's really nowhere to go from that.
Wow. Steve sounds like things really are going well.
So, today we have a very special guest with us. Someone I've known for a while and, just one of those PCI gurus who understands what PCI is for and what it's realistically going to be able to accomplish for us. The always pleasant, Brandon Williams. So, what I'm going to do is Yvette set all this up. I'm going to turn it over to Yvette. You can do the full up introduction. Tell us all the things that you love and hate about Brandon.
It's a long list.
and then we'll dive into the topic.
Yep. So Brandon's been a QSA. He's led a QSA practice. He's written two books on PCI compliance, served on the board of advisors for the PCI Council. And we can all blame him for bringing me into the dark side that's called security consulting.
But he also makes really good barbecue, so he's got that going for him.
Correct. If he ever decided to throw down with Bobby Flay, I think he would be pretty competitive. So thank you, Brandon, for joining the podcast tonight.
Yeah, thanks. That's probably the best compliment right there. Forget the PCI stuff, the barbecue. That was the best one.
So PCI has moved into its next iteration, 3.0, and I'm sure everybody's read all the new changes. But what we're here to talk about is a blog post that you had a couple of weeks ago called The Good, the Bad, and the Confusing, which pretty much just summarizes the changes of PCI but in a better way, better than the actual summary of changes that we all see as PCI is coming up to its next iteration. So we just want to talk a little bit about that. Do you want to give us a quick summary?
Sure. So this version of the standard, this one was 3 years in the making. So 3 years ago when they released 2.0, they changed the schedule and said, we're going to do this every 3 years instead of every 2 years. There's good reasons for that. Part of it is it takes people a little bit, these level one merchants, it takes them a little bit longer to implement changes. And a 3 year cycle allows it to fit within most budgetary cycles for planning and implementation. The bad side is if things come up, they are pretty much forced to use the errata process to try to add or change requirements if there's some sort of an emerging threat or an attack they feel a requirement could fix. You kind of still have a little bit of the moving target, although theoretically it's slowed down, and they did not use the errata process in the last version. The last time they used it was for, if anybody remembers, version 1.2.1. There was a 1 at the end of that. It was an errata was released to clarify a couple things. I think that there are some really great things about what's changed, things that'll make it easier for people. I also think that there's some things that are a little confusing, as I mentioned in the blog post. There's some kind of things standing at odds, if you will. You know, I think the community really has two sides to this. And without, you know, breaking any confidentiality agreements, I can tell you that in meetings that I've had with high-level folks, if there's an even number of them in the room, pretty much half's on one side and half's on the other side. And the one side is we need more stringent requirements or more descriptive requirements so that we can reduce the interpretation bias and problems from QSAs. And then the other half of the room is saying, well, we need more flexibility. We need more risk-based approach. And, you know, it really gets down to the people on the side for more stringent QSAs or more stringent requirements or more descriptive requirements, however you want to phrase it, really are upset because they don't feel like they're getting a fair shot. They want to do the right thing, and they're fully engaged, but they feel like that they're struggling implementing something that everybody would agree is compliant. And the ones on the other side of the table, some of them are really good, smart security people that really understand that, hey, we need to put a little bit of brains into this and fix it. But the rest of them are people who just don't want to do any work. So we can talk through some of the changes. I don't know if there's anything in particular that struck your fancy. I know the blog post highlighted a few, I think, that are going to be pretty critical.
Well, so talking about the we want more flexibility, one of the first things you call out is periodic now appears 20 times, right? Up from 8, which is, as a QSA, continues to be a pain point. Because what does periodic mean? How do you define that? Is it 1 month? Is it 10 months? Is it 10 years?
Yep.
And
that one and the other one, I think that you're about to say, which was should, the increase in that one. So I'll just kind of back up a little bit. In version 1.2, there seemed to be a crusade to remove a lot of that ambiguity. They wanted to remove the word should because they felt there was a suggestion, and QSAs felt like it was a suggestion, and change that and make that the word must or require or something where it's kind of definitive, yes or no, I have to actually take action for something. And the periodic stuff, with the exception of like key rotation, was removed out. There was a lot of periodic words that were, you know, kind of a derivative of that root, which made it confusing for the exact reason that you mentioned. So my rule of thumb when I was a QSA was, well, you got to at least do it annually because I have to have evidence that you're actually doing something. Like, you can't just say, well, we're going to do this once every 20 years and we're going to do it 20 years from now. Right. So that doesn't really show that. I mean, a QSA is really, it's going to be hard pressed to put something in the documentation of them observing this control in place. But the number of shoulds, so in the post, I counted it up. So we went from, let's see, what did I have? It was 27 originally. 27 times the word should appeared in version 2.0. And now in 3.0, we're up to 103. So I think the challenge that we're going to see is there is going to be a lot more bias between QSAs, which is a crowd of folks that in a lot of cases is pressed because – they're, you know, you don't make a lot of money doing assessments. They're usually not priced very well, for at least for an assessor. They're priced great for the people that are being assessed because they're fairly cheap now, which means that the people that are there probably don't really understand the underlying technology of what they're looking at. I'd be hard-pressed to find many QSAs nowadays that could really understand if someone said something like this. I have my credit card data in a vSAM file that's sitting on this Sysplex over here. It's got 2 LPARs on it, and it's protected by RACF, and here's the profile that shows how it's protected. That many of them would really do anything other than go, uh-huh, okay.
Sounds good to me.
No, they would ask you what GPOs you've applied to that.
Exactly, yeah. Do you have any GPOs, or isn't that mandatory or discretionary access? I'm not really sure. Yeah, it's very frustrating because they just simply don't understand a lot of that stuff. So I think that the, you know, words like that really will help confuse and create more ambiguity, which – it could create easy passes, and it could create very challenging assessment periods.
What else did you? What were you saying that was still pretty ambiguous and ambiguous in the DSS in the new version?
So there's a couple things that were dropped in that are just simply confusing to me. In the executive summary, there's this whole section on business as usual and integrating PCI DSS into what they call business as usual, which I actually heard this term used much more outside of the States than I do inside the States, because we would sit in meetings and they would ask about BAUs, and I'd have to kind of ask and stop, what are you talking about? Oh, business as usual, like normal standard practice. So, well, I think everybody agrees that the underlying controls that PCI is addressing should be part of your business process should you choose to take on the risk of processing credit cards and doing whatever you're doing with that data. I just find it really out of place to be sitting basically in the summary or the executive summary section of the standard with no requirement saying that you have to do anything. It's just a suggestion. And so when I think about, you know, they took up some precious space, which the page count went from like 70 something to 100 something. I don't know the exact number. I think it was 76 to 104 or something like that in the new version. And to take up space with something like that when you have the wireless and the cloud guidelines that are sitting in the guideline section of the council's document section, you know, it just it seemed kind of strange to me. One of the reasons why it got longer, by the way, is they combined a couple of documents. So this is actually very helpful. They took the navigating PCI DSS document and combined it into the standard PCI document that you'll see when you download on the website. That, frankly, I think is really awesome because it cuts down on the amount of work that people have to do with managing multiple documents, and it really kind of aligns all the assumptions up from left to right. There are still some discrepancies. We found a couple. I don't have them specifically in front of me, but there are a couple that just, you know, when you read the guideline, you say, okay, I understand where you're going with that, but it doesn't necessarily line up with the requirement. So it's going to come down to a judgment call.
Agreed. I mean, I quite frequently in using the last version would toggle back and forth between the DSS and navigating the DSS, just because I felt like the navigating was a little more in layman's terms and broke down the requirement to what you could, a little more readable for everybody.
Yeah.
Hey, so can I jump in here?
Sure.
Yes.
All right. So as someone who does consulting but doesn't, I'm definitely not a QSA, thank God. And and I'm not directly involved with PCI. What are the major differences that I need to know between 2.0 and 3.0?
That's a great question. There's a couple that are pretty important to understand. I think one of the first ones is there was an attempt. This was a valiant effort, by the way, but the execution was not fantastic. I'll just kind of say it that way. There was an attempt to line up documentation for policy alongside the requirements that actually had a documentation requirement. So kind of in the back of your mind, you're thinking, wow, I can see how this thing got pretty lengthy because theoretically they would have popped in documentation requirements alongside every single sub-requirement that has a need for this. And the reality, what they did is they just added a requirement to the end of all of the 12 requirements that says, make sure you have all the documentation in place and double check it twice. So again, well-intentioned, it's actually probably a little bit easier for an assessor to go through it that way as opposed to checking each one. It's just not kind of what I was envisioning when they talked about it in their first press release. I also think that the requirement around, it's requirement 9.9, which is around terminal integrity and checking for tampering. I think that's going to be a bigger problem than a lot of people believe it will be. I mentioned that to a reporter who published it, and then he went over to Troy, and Troy said, nah, it's not going to be as big of a deal. And for the level four merchant, it really isn't going to be that big of a deal at all, because typically they only have two or three terminals. Maybe if they were a larger level four with multiple sites, it starts to become an issue. But if you just start doing some basic math in your head, let's say that, because it says periodically, this is one of the periodics, it doesn't say how often you have to do it, but let's just say you're checking for it quarterly, which is probably not nearly enough. So maybe we'll do it monthly. How about monthly? That's a little bit better. It makes the math work out. So if I have 100 stores and I have 12 locations, 100 stores with 12 cash lanes. So right there, we're looking at 1,200 devices that I have to check every single time that I go through this. So there's 1,200 audit logs that are being created, 1,200 records. Now I start to do that quarterly or monthly, and you start to see that those numbers get pretty big, pretty fast, where we're talking about thousands of devices that need to be checked. So small merchants, not going to be as big of a deal. Once you start to get into a level one merchant, it is going to be a big deal to keep track of all that stuff. I think something else that's kind of interesting that, again, is well-intentioned and is long overdue is the pen testing methodology. So they talk about having a pen testing methodology. It needs to be evaluated. Doesn't really say what it needs to be evaluated against, though. So, you know, again, we kind of run into this ambiguity problem of, well, I can look at it, and if I think it looks good, because maybe, you know, I haven't done a pen test before, but look, you said you're doing this thing called a scan, and then you're doing this thing called the Metasploits, and then also these other things that I can't pronounce that start with PWN usually, so I guess that's okay. But, if it was backed up against something with a little bit more of a regimented approach, perhaps using something from NIST or even requiring something from NIST, it could potentially have had a little bit more direction. But I think it's going to cause people trouble because as they go to define what that methodology is, they may run into challenges with their QSAs not really either understanding or wanting to buy into it. But again, it is long overdue because prior to this, You know, there was just suggestions and best practices around it. So I think that this is something that will, it'll be troublesome, but ultimately it is a very good outcome. How about one really great change that I love, which is, you know, the removing ambiguity and requirement 3.2. What the word choice that they used was to make secondary authentication data post authorization, so after the authorization occurs, unrecoverable. And to me, that I think is kind of the best choice word they could have used, because that really gets to A, the intent, and B, the execution. So it's not separating it so I can piece it back together later, or being encrypted, or no, it's not really when you look at it right here, but you know, maybe if I wave my magic wand, it comes back. It just has to be unrecoverable. So for any retailer that is trying to get around some of these secondary authentication requirements by doing some fancy stuff, because maybe they don't want to pay the extra money to their processor for doing digital wallet storage, they're probably going to have to switch that up.
What about the changes to the five requirements, specifically around like antivirus?
That one is interesting because what the change that was made there that always kind of strikes people, they have to read it a couple times when it comes up, because they want you to look for malware in systems that are not commonly affected by malware. So you kind of have to have a practice in theory that says that you're going to be looking for malware on, say, a mainframe or
mainframe.
Yeah. I mean, that's, but, you know, if you were to take a lesser extreme, you could look at, say, a Linux system or an OS X, you know, a Mac system. So, you know, in some respects, I'd almost argue that if there's an antivirus client available for it, you might as well just put it on there. They're very ineffective overall. But, you know, if your antivirus client is crashing your server, which I've heard of this happening before, there might be larger issues that need to be addressed versus just putting antivirus on a particular server.
And I think that's one of the things that really interested me about this was, if you, let's say you are a level one merchant and you've got a QSA coming in, and I'm not saying that there are any individuals doing the QSA function who are really difficult to get along with. I can assume they exist, but you know, if you're
so
running,
was that a pause for a reason or
what's that about?
So if you're running a TPS system, or you're running, you know, Big Iron, you could run into a, you know, QSA who just fell off the turnip truck, who is going to demand and insist that somehow you come up with these processes for detecting malware. And because there's not a malware client that I'm aware of that runs on these systems, you're going to have to come up with some very stupid, well, we're going to, you know, whatever it is. And I just, why couldn't they just come out and say, if there's a client available, you have to use it, which was sort of the way I interpreted the standard before.
They have to be very careful about saying things like that. If you remember, they've spent some time in some congressional hearings a couple of times, and Congress is not necessarily on board with an organization like this that's going to drive or impact markets. So imagine for a second that they were to say that, they would, you know, essentially revive a dying antivirus market by saying that. While I do agree that that's probably the intent, I think it's just going to cause interpretation issues. If I'm a security professional and I'm managing my infrastructure, I'm probably going to be at some point looking for any sort of a vulnerability that is, if I'm going to follow H.D. Moore's law, I'm going to look for any vulnerability that's sitting in Metasploit or any of the automated tested toolkits. That's what I want to focus all my efforts on. So if there is, if, for example, I'm running a mainframe system and I've got some sort of like a Java piece sitting in a CICS region, and maybe it's a little bit outdated, and there's a particular attack for this thing that would start with a worm or start with a piece of malcode that could be installed. It's really designed to try to kind of get you to beef up your security a little bit more and think that, understand that even though it's mainframe, it's not infallible, which I think is kind of, when I was an assessor, that's what I always got. I said, but it's in the mainframe. It's got RACF, you know, it's all super secure. You know, in the meantime, there's no encryption on any of the password stuff. I'm catching stuff in the clear. You know, it's a system that has a lot of great security benefits, but most enterprises don't configure them in a way that maximizes that payload.
Well, one of the interesting things that I think Martin and I saw last 2012 at B-Sides was a presentation about mainframes and really what it talked about was what's old is new, right? So that the mainframes are coming back around because of their security. But I do agree to what you're saying. Is it because they're so secure, or is it because people just don't know enough about them to impact them?
So I would argue that it's probably a knowledge of an assessor side where people don't know. Like, I think that there's enough folks out in the industry that if there is a target that's juicy enough, they'll figure out how to break into a mainframe, right? And if you have a targeted attack, you know, all bets are off. PCI can't save you from a targeted attack. It will save you from the casual drive-by, and it does have baseline security practices that are, you know, I would argue are good. A lot of people don't agree with a lot of what's in PCI. I would say that, you know, there are some challenges in running a standard that's this big. You're always going to have people that hate it, but it did seem to do some good for boosting, you know, secure information security at retail, who really never considered anything outside of theft to be a security issue. My experience being that the large systems are coming back because of their processing power, and because we're kind of reminding ourselves that, well, cloud's not a new technology. Like, we've been doing this since the 70s. And we can leverage some of the power that we have here to do kind of a lot of cross analysis and live systems, and there's redundancy and other types of things that are in there. I mean, there's reasons why it's coming back. I would argue it didn't necessarily really go that far away. I think that people became enamored with distributed computing until some of the technologies were able to be replicated in a mainframe environment.
Got it. So let's jump over to requirement 10, which I call the logging and monitoring requirements. But I know something changed for 10.6. What was the change on that one?
So essentially, what they're trying to do is they're trying to help companies not only understand what they need to do for compliance, but also help them understand, from an assessor's perspective, what they should look for. So in the previous requirements around 10 and log review, it simply just said, hey, you got to have a procedure. You got to do daily log review. And now what they've done is they've really kind of broken it out to say, no, you need to review these things at least daily. Here's the types of events that you're looking at. Here's how they fit in. And keeping in mind, by the way, that the scope of this document is only for the cardholder data environment. So if you're looking at things outside of that environment, this doesn't necessarily apply. So we got when you're looking from an assessor perspective, as well as being, designing it inside your systems, you have to remember that this applies to the cardholder data environment only. But the way that they reworded it and phrased it, I think is actually pretty helpful. I mean, it gives you a lot more specifics on what are the things that you should be doing. It's basically a review process, an investigative process, and then a follow-up process.
Got it. So what other big hits occurred that you feel are good for 3.0 versus what we're really missing? Anything else jumping out?
So things that are really good. There's one other missing thing I do want to see if I can remember to talk about. But I think on the really good side, looking at requirement 8, all the changes that they made to authentication, and really kind of helping a user understand the different ways they could configure authentication to be compliant. I think all that stuff's really great. I wish that there was a little bit more linkage down to the other standards. So, you know, for example, we're not going to create a bunch of requirements around mobile, but it would be great to have like a mobile, not even a best practices, more like a requirements document for mobile, and then have the standard reference that. That way, you know, they can keep the standard somewhat pure, if you will, and then focus on the smaller other technologies, emerging technologies, and their own standards. I think those are kind of, I mean, the rest of them, a lot of them are cleanup. Stuff around third parties, I think, is really good. It just kind of helps to create the documentation. And you know, there's things that are requirements now that I don't understand how you do PCI without it, like having a data flow diagram. Right. I don't know how you do PCI without having that, but it's never been a requirement to have a data flow diagram. It is now. Maintaining a list of in-scope systems. I think that one is going to be really, really challenging, especially for environments that are heavily virtualized. But again, I don't know how you do PCI without having that master list. So those are good things.
Right. And then anything else that you feel is bad or still just you wish would have been addressed in this version, or maybe that should be addressed in the next version?
I think that, you know, it was around the linkage. That's the one complaint that I've had for a while now, is that we've created a lot of documentation, but there's not a clear linkage to go from, you know, somebody who wants to run, say, a mobile app or a mobile infrastructure and do it, and they want to do the right things. They, you know, they're actually trying and actively trying to do the right things, but they don't have a way to look at it from the PCI perspective's eyes and say, okay, at a minimum, your mobile technology must do these five things, which is kind of unique or different from, say, a distributed computer.
So I got a quick question, and I think our two PCI experts could go ahead and talk about this. Think about all of the pain and the problems you run into now with 2.0 and all of the difficulties, you know, you see frequently. With 3.0, will those problems still exist, or do we have a solid step up and it's going to eliminate some of them? Or is it a situation where they're still going to persist and now you've got to deal with a whole new set of issues? And what are they? What are some of the common things?
I think it is a combination of both. There are some things that have been simplified that are great. There's some things that are a lot more complex. Document management is going to be, it's an order of magnitude more difficult with 3.0. And it was the same thing in 2.0. It was an order of magnitude more difficult with 2.0. So we are going to have a huge problem with document management, keeping all that stuff up to date. At some point, I don't know if this is the version that makes people think about it, but at some point people should be considering, you know, why do I even process these things myself? I should just be paying an extra, you know, couple of basis points and give it to somebody else to process. And that way I don't have any liability or problems at all. And I'm kind of covered.
Do you think that's the way that's sort of knowingly or unknowing the direction the council is deliberately pushing folks?
I don't think they're deliberately doing that. I'm not speaking from any authority. I mean, I got to tell you, Bob Rousseau's got probably one of the most difficult jobs in the whole thing, because he's got five bosses that hate each other. You know, I mean, they collectively get in a room and talk, but they're fierce competitors. And so he can't really say anything without, you know, it's the classic TPS report example. Like, he can't say anything without approval from his five bosses. Right. He's got a script. So I would not say that they are unconsciously moving people that way. I would argue, though, that if I'm in this business and I'm processing credit cards, I really have to take a hard look at it. I mean, there's so many great technologies out there that make it so easy to do.
Right. Well, guys, we have had a fantastic conversation, and we have run out of time. So, Brandon, thanks for joining us all the way from Dublin. I know there are things you'd rather be doing at this time of the evening out in Dublin, so I will let you get back to those things. So on behalf of everyone here at the Southern Fried Security Podcast and our good friend Brandon Williams, good night, and we'll talk to you soon.